Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
In addition to talking to business and government leaders here at the Global Energy Transition Summit, we've visited with journalists who are reporting on the climate crisis around the world. In this episode, we're pleased to welcome Carlos Beltran, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and producer with the Climate Unit at NBC News. Thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you.
We're going to have a lot to talk about, but let's just start by talking about you and maybe your journey and where you've been, and you're doing such exciting things at NBC, but just talk about yourself and what motivates you to do what you're doing.
I think that's always the hardest question you can get. Just tell us about yourself. Well, currently I'm, of course, a producer at NBC News. I guess on my day-to-day, I'm a storyteller, first and foremost, so I focus most of my time on climate-related stories. I can elaborate that in a minute, but I also have personal projects I do, from feature films to books to whatnot.
So you've done some great ones.
Well, thank you. So, I mean, it's sometimes not to get into the whole topic of are you a journalist or a storyteller or whatnot. I think every journalist is a storyteller. It's just that we deal with non-facts or we deal with facts depending on what you focus on. So, yeah, traveling a lot. I'm happy to be here. I just got back from San Francisco from a three-day conference. So, that's how much I respect your show there, Tucker.
We're really glad to have you. You know, is the story about climate as you tell it, is it a story about people being impacted? Is it a story about science? Right. How do you tell that story with film?
One of the biggest challenges when it comes to covering climate is that a lot of people, the public tends to be desensitized to data, to projections. Oh, that's something that's going to happen in 30, 50 years or whatnot. So my role in telling climate stories is to humanize the problem, to find the human angle, to find the story about someone who is being directly and immediately affected by the crisis. So that's the biggest challenge. Of course, data is very important. We do have in our unit at NBC meteorologists and scientists and people who collect amazing data, and we use that in my reporting. Yeah,
it's awesome. It's a great, I find, as someone who studies it every day, all day, and has a lot of people advising me that are studying it, it's still so complex that no one can almost get their arms around. You have to know about how electricity is produced, transported, used, traded, the rules, the policies. The whole energy system is so complex that it's almost impossible to get your arms around it. And to narrow that down into a sound bite for 2 minutes or 3 minutes is almost impossible. I applaud your effort.
Well, thank you. I'm also lucky that, yeah, sure thing. When we're talking about broadcasts and traditional broadcasts, then you talk about these stories that last a minute and a half to 2 minutes, you know, 2:30, 3 minutes on national television, primetime and whatnot, which is a great spot, but how can you develop a story? How can you really tell it in just 3 minutes? We do have, though, at NBC, other outlets where I've, you know, turned a story that I put on nightly news that lasted 3 minutes, I made it into a 12-minute story where you actually get to see the characters and dive a little deeper.
And so, can people find that on NBC.com?
Yeah, absolutely. NBC.com, YouTube, you know, we have plenty of our content over there as well. And I'll be happy to talk more about this, but in my position, my day-to-day, I produce stories, tell stories on, say, TikTok and Snapchat, like 45, 60 seconds, just top of mind thing. But I also do stories for Nightly News Films, which, again, are like 12-minute stories. Today's Show, Nightly News, and our streaming service, NBC News Now and Peacock. So we have, you know, a plethora of outlets.
You've got the outlets.
Yeah.
And NBC is really, I mean, sees climate reporting as something so important that they've created a climate unit, right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So NBC has always had a weather unit. Al Roker has been the face not only of the network.
I've heard his name before.
Yeah, right? It's a guy that, you know, is around. He's great. In the past, though, before the climate unit was put together, obviously the weather unit, aside from weather-related, like weather events and extreme events, they pitched to several shows, stories that were climate-centric. The climate unit, however, is how the network formalized climate-centric reporting. 2020, 2021, that's when they said, let's put a team together to just focus on climate stories. And that's how they brought me in as a producer. Yeah.
Any trends or stories that you're working on now that just are fascinating to you around the climate? I mean, today we sit here today where we're having a really unique event with the fire and the smoke. But any trends you like you're kind of following or developing? Any stories that really are impactful to you?
So, I mean, the thing about climate and climate change is that it's intersectional in nature. I mean, if I do a story on environmental justice, that could very well be also a story about activism, corporate accountability or so. So that's what I really find interesting about covering climate. It has different points of view. So I wouldn't tell you that there's a specific trend. I, in particular, try to focus on stories that talk about, again, the human aspect, communities. I try to go hyper-local, but also with a little bit of a universal flair to it. So environmental justice stories are the ones that I try to focus on.
And you haven't always really been a climate reporter. We were talking before we went on live about a lot of your political journal work. Right. You know, you've done drug trafficking. You've done some really cool stories. How did you get to climate?
My wife asked me to stop doing that now. look, I came into climate reporting the same way that I've gone into any of the other stories and subjects you mentioned. I'm curious. It's about the storytelling. How do I connect emotionally with people in front of the camera and the audience, right? But I also understand climate change to be the quintessential challenge for humanity today. So it was a challenge. I was covering all sorts of beats and issues and trends until 2020, 2021. And then when I got invited to be a producer, not only for broadcast, but also for digital and social media at the network, I thought, that's going to be a challenge, and I love that. Not to be so stereotypical about, oh, I love a good challenge, but I just figured that that was a way for me to feel like I was making an impact through my work, is focusing on climate, yeah.
The work we saw on Earth Day from NBC was about repair, I guess the repair story, whatever. That was your story, right?
Yeah, it was.
It's part of your story?
Yeah.
Fascinating. And can maybe walk through that. I mean, I think it's funny, the next day I had a very similar situation where I was like, I don't really want to throw this away, but I had to throw it away because there was nowhere to get it repaired.
Right.
Just walk through that Earth Day story about how you started and how it finished.
So that's another one of those stories that checks many boxes, because this is a story that at first is hyper-local. It was a small community in Tarrytown, New York, that came together for one day to essentially fix each other's appliances, each other's junk, you know, from lamps to vacuums to bikes to sweaters for free. But that is part of what's called a Repair Café movement, which is a movement that started in 2009 in Amsterdam. Somehow, by 2011, it got here to the U.S., and now there are hundreds of these pop-up experiences in the U.S., called Repair Cafes. So the highlight of that story was that not only did I get to do a taped segment, which was about a 2 minute or so story, but also we were able to bring all those people that I interviewed and I met in Tarrytown, New York, to the plaza at 30 Rock for a live event. So on the day right before Earth Day, we had some 20 or so volunteers fixing things right next to Savannah and Hoda at the very iconic 30 Rock Plaza. So, you know, we were able to put such a local yet important story in front of everybody. You know?
It's really, I'm a big fan of NBC in general, and that the Earth Day coverage to me was fascinating. You've also really, I think, you've done a lot of work through South America, and you kind of are one of the few people talking about maybe the immigration crisis, with, I might argue, adaptation, having to leave a place. Ties it all together. We did a fascinating story, I think, really about the migration crisis from the perspective of the Guatemalan community.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Right. So that story you're referring to Guatemala, that was, I think, the first international story that was climate-related that I did for Nightly News back in 2021. I think I went to Guatemala just a few weeks after Vice President Kamala Harris visited the country to talk about some funding for a program that essentially would help Guatemalans to remain in the country and kind of discourage the migration over to the U.S. Let's fix the problems at home. But at that point, nothing had been done, and I actually met with a group of farmers who had lost basically everything, their crops, whether they were growing corn or coffee, they had lost everything, and they were desperate. So basically what they had to do was just to leave their homes, and, you know, it's kind of the story that we hear often, leave their homes and then just look for a better life somewhere else. And yes, we do. I did get to see extreme cases of malnutrition, kids, children, infants, who had not eaten for days, basically because families, especially in the rural parts of the country, depend on the crops that they are able to grow. And with torrential rains and extreme droughts, I mean, they were obliterated. So yeah, that's one of those stories that we put on Nightly News with Lester Holt, and then it turned into a two-part Nightly News film. So, yeah, just kind of dwell more on it.
I can only imagine the situations that you're able to go to and see and think about it. I think your view changes when you're behind the camera. Mm-hmm. Talk about maybe a story or two in your experience where it impacted you, where you said climate change is real, this needs to be fixed.
I mean, it's hard to pinpoint one. Last year I worked on a story it hit me a bit in El Paso, Texas. Basically, we talked to a group of mothers in a majority Hispanic community who were basically pleading to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to look into chemical and recycling plants that were in El Paso, Texas, because these mothers claimed that the pollution levels were outstanding. I talked to doctors who would say that, yeah, cases of respiratory illnesses in children were just getting worse. So I did spend a few days with these mothers, and I mean, I was there to kind of try to hold some of these companies accountable, if that was the case. Basically, the state of Texas was saying that the pollution there by the U.S. and Mexico border was coming from Mexico, so that technically they couldn't do anything about it. So yeah, it is one of those stories that touched policy, it touched families, it touched, you know, you can get emotional because these mothers are basically just caring, not for something abstract, right, but for their children who they see, you know, having to use their asthma, you know, inhalers, things every day.
And truly don't have, and we talk a lot about environmental equity and justice and those people who probably really can't change their situation very easily. A classic example, they couldn't leave, right? That's their community. Right. Leaving that community wasn't really a choice.
Right, but I figure, like, that's another thing. Like, I think an easy way to go about it, and incorrect, I think ignorant way to go about it, is just say, okay, well, if you're not happy somewhere, well, then move or go away. People sometimes don't have the wherewithal to do that. And when you build your entire life around a support system, a community, it's just a lot more difficult to do so, yeah.
You recently did a story, which actually, again, impacted me as I think about being a coastal landowner. Mm-hmm. New Jersey shoreline using coconuts. Well, tell us about that.
Yeah, so when people talk about sea level rise, again, there's this notion that, okay, well, Miami is going to be underwater in 50 years or something like that, or I don't live near the coast, so that's not going to affect me. When we talk about sea level rise, we're also talking about erosion. So the most immediate effect that sea level rise has is the eroding shorelines that are disappearing. Small town, Neptune, New Jersey, basically, they had two options. They said, okay, well, our shoreline, beloved beach, is being eroded away. We can either put a bulkhead made out of metal or cement, so we safeguard the shoreline, or which effectively would affect the ecosystem, or we go the more natural approach to it, which is one of these things called, the trend is called natural solutions. So, the image that I had in my mind when I first heard about this was, okay, it's a row of coconuts. Great. You know, coconuts and beaches. That's very visual. Essentially, what you do is you take the husk or the core out of the coconut, and that is processed and weaved together into coconut logs, basically. This is a story that I did with Dylan Dreyer. She was the one, the correspondent on it. And these coconuts are processed in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India. They're imported, you know, to the U.S., and then they are placed along the shoreline. With time, the coconuts become part of the ecosystem, and the shoreline is then protected, right? That sounds extremely elaborate, having to import the coconut, because we don't produce it here. It's still about half as expensive as using metals and cement to safeguard the shorelines. So I thought that was an interesting way to do about it, and it's actually not just happening in New Jersey, it's happening in other parts of the country. So that's another one of those stories where it's like, let's focus on our community, and let's see how that is, you know, rippling around the country.
If it makes you feel any better, the day that story ran, I saw it, and within 10 minutes, I'm Googling where I could get those coconut husk for a very similar project.
Well, there you go.
So it shows you the impact of what you're doing. I know you feel that.
That's fantastic.
Let's just even talk about today and the process you go through. You didn't really wake up here today. I know you've traveled in from the West Coast to be here today, but in just a few minutes, you're going to go to the office. Okay. Tell us about your day.
So
do you know today what your work's going to be, or are they going to tell you when you get there, you'll sit?
I know it's going to be wild.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, so the way that the climate unit works at NBC is more of a production hub. We're a production house, you can see it like that. Basically what we do, we have a team of researchers, producers, you know, camera people, editors. What we do is we pitch stories. That's our day-to-day. It's researching, looking at what's out in the news, looking what's coming ahead, and pitching these stories to every show. Again, we pitch to the Today Show, Nightly News, and traditional media. Then we have News Now, which is a streaming service, and then we have social media. Stay tuned, Snapchat, whatnot. And then we grab these stories, so what we do is we pitch them. If a show is interested, then we do the research. We can do the producing, the filming, the writing, and the editing. So that's why I call ourselves a full house production, you know, or a full production house, or a house production hub. So that's it. So today, for example, I'll pitch some stories, and I'll work on stories, logistics for a story that I'm shooting in 2 weeks in Portland, Oregon, for example. But on a day-to-day, I'm working on three different stories, whether it's an article that I'm writing with our associate producer, or whether it's helping another unit, you know, film another story, you know? So it's, I have my hands on everywhere. I don't only do, that's another thing, that I don't only, my day-to-day is climate, but when I get to, just because I like also, you know, diversity, I help other units produce their stories as well.
But it does sound like at some point in time, you're always working on a short-term or a today thing that could be socially used, or, but then you always have a long-term project in mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. It's good. Well, your work is great. I said we're going to talk mainly about climate, but when we have you on the podcast, we have to talk about some of your other work because it's been absolutely amazing. And this probably was outside of your work at NBC. Mm-hmm. You did an art book. I think you called it an experimental biography of Venezuela. Is that correct?
I did. Yes.
It suddenly occurred to me, title. Talk about it.
So back in 2000, and I'll try to make this short.
Did it suddenly occur to you?
It suddenly occurred to me, but it took me 12 years to put it together.
That's what I would have thought.
Back in 2009, I was in Venezuela. I was between Venezuela and Colombia. And back then, I was working in advertising. I went to school for journalism and advertising. And by, you know, 2010, I was getting burnt out. On my free time, I would take this old 35-millimeter, you know, camera with black and white film, and I would go around areas of the city where I was born, Caracas, and I would just meet people, and I would photograph their reality, the day-to-day. It's just a personal project. I had no idea what it would become. In 2011, 2012, I was producing a documentary on the precarious prison system in Venezuela. Basically, what does social, you know, reinsertion, you know, for ex-convicts look like over there? And I met this woman, one of the featured people in the documentary, who's incredible. Yadira is her name. And she wrote, the way that she wrote, she expressed, she doesn't talk too much, but the way that she writes is so visceral, it's so raw. She comes from a very precarious background. She spent 8 years in some of the worst prisons in Venezuela. And the way that she expressed herself, I just fell in love with it. I only was able to put part of it in the documentary, but I told her, why don't we do something with your texts? Because she wrote just for herself, everything by hand. Why don't we just do something with it? And I'm talking 2012. And we started working. I was inspired by a book called The Sweet Flight Paper of Life. It was a collaboration between Langston Hughes, of course, great American writer, and Roy de Caraba, a great photographer. And basically, they told the story of Harlem in the mid-1950s through photographs and text, like a combination of both. And I showed her the book, and I said, why don't we just do something like that? And we did. We started working on this book, putting together her text and my photographs of the city, kind of playing off each other to tell the reality, her reality, because some of my photographs were of places that she saw and lived through. By 2014, the vice president of Venezuela called me out on national television, because I had been covering, you know, sensible issues in Venezuela, and I had to leave, and the project came to a halt. By 2018, I was already living in New York, and it just so happened that I ran into one of the photographs that I had taken by that time 8 years ago. And I connected again with Yadira. By then, she had been exiled from Venezuela. She was living in Colombia. And I said, let's just do it. Let's just jump on it. And it was a passion project. It took us 2 years to put all the texts together. We had to find her notebooks, transcribe them, digitize them, filter them, like edit them, and translate them to English. And then a designer put everything together. Right when we went to press, the pandemic hit. So that just brought us another 2 years of having to wait for the book. At any rate, the book came out wonderfully. It's an art book, only 200 copies. So it's very limited run. But all the proceeds are going to humanitarian, charities in the U.S. and Venezuela.
If someone wanted to buy that book, where would they find it?
There's the site for the book is suddenlyproject.com. That's it. And then you get to see everything in the book, the process of building the book, and then you can buy it from there.
Awesome. Yeah. Great story. All right, let's have a little fun. First thing we're going to do is we're going to hand you a magic wand. You're going to use that magic wand to change one thing in the next year regarding sustainability and climate.
As a journalist, I believe that my work, whether I'm covering climate or other issues or politics, is to pinpoint and call out inconsistencies. So I guess if I had my way, I would ask for actionable corporate accountability. I do believe that if policymakers and regulators push, the biggest corporations to meet their carbon emission goals and to reduce these emissions, then we can have an impact. I think that is feasible. That is something that is feasible. Hopefully, I don't need a magic wand for that, but I think that's something that we can do to make a difference.
Great use. I'm going to ask you a slightly unfair question. I'm even going to give you a chance to say I don't want to answer that. But I just feel like you're in the game every day. You're listening to the conversation. You're seeing the results of inaction and sometimes action, I think. Mm-hmm. You have to develop some personal beliefs around climate change and maybe solutions. Mm-hmm. You want to share with us just personally, beyond your role at NBC, but your role as a person who's seeing this day in, day out. Mm-hmm. Where's the conversation right, and where does the conversation need to be changed?
I think there's a notion that the conversation needs to, I think, focus on the fact that eventually, if we do nothing, it's something that is going to affect everybody.
And so clearly you think we're not doing enough and not doing it fast enough. We're talking and not acting. That's one thing.
But I think so. But I think I don't think there's a sense of urgency still. You have mm-hmm. to, if you understand... I think the most unfair thing is that we've known for years now that the most vulnerable communities to the effects of climate change are also the ones who contribute the least to the problem.
Right.
And you have, 75% of people living under the poverty line in rural areas around the world depend on these natural resources that are being destroyed by all these, events, from extreme droughts to wildfires. The latest IPCC report says that within the next 30 years, 140 million people will be displaced worldwide. So... I have to understand that this is something that will affect millions of people, and it'll eventually hit you. Like here in New York today, mm-hmm. I have to wear a mask. I hadn't worn a mask in a year and a half since the pandemic, and now I have to wear a mask because of the wildfires in Canada. So it is directly affecting me in the middle of Times Square in New York. So I would say, yeah, the urgency. When it comes to action, a lot of people will say, What do I do? What do I do? Donate money? I don't have any. What do I recycle? Sure, we've seen the trash ends up in the same dump by the ocean. So what do I do? And that's the question, right?
Do you think the lack of urgency is because the problem is so immense, or because there's corporate stonewalling, people don't want to act, they don't know how to act?
Right.
Where do you think that lack of urgency comes from?
Well, there's just so much that I can say, especially when it comes to corporations. But I think that the lack of urgency is precisely because if you focus only on data and projections, that is so distant from, how that is really going to affect me that you just leave it on mm-hmm. a side. But that, I guess, if I can cheat and go back to corporate accountability, I do believe that corporations can do a lot more, especially I'm talking about big conglomerates that can do a lot more to set the path straight to...
I think that's what I would have expected you to say. And I don't think any of us mm-hmm. could say anything different if we
sure.
see every day what you're seeing. You're seeing the real world impact and the real world pain,
right.
I think, of this. So we agree. I mean, I think we agree. We often hear talk about that, doing something now
right.
is better than waiting 30 years to
right.
do something that you think might be better
right.
than doing something now.
Yeah, if I'm ever in a behind-closed-doors conversation about it, I know something else, I'll call you. We'll do another one of these.
Sense of urgency is never a bad thing,
right,
no matter what we're talking about.
Right.
All right, one thing we love to do, I mean, you've given us so much of your time and your expertise. We're going to try to give a little back. We'd like to plant a tree in a national forest in your name, in respect for you being with us today. Where do you go into that? Where is that national forest?
That's a wonderful gesture. Thank you. I don't know. It's not a forest. Remember I told you about this community in El Paso? There's a national park. It's a national memorial, a place where there are some trees over there. I don't know if you can plant trees over there, but if it was possible, that's a great gesture for that community that desperately needs more clean air. Otherwise, I'm not sure. Yellowstone?
We can find a good place in El Paso to do that.
It would be a nice gesture for those. Yeah.
Our team will enjoy researching that.
Good.
All right, we're going to wrap up in a second, but I know you've got so much to tell us. Anything we've not asked you that you'd like to say about kind of your work, climate, NBC, anything you want to leave us with?
I'm extremely proud, and I feel the responsibility as a communicator to focus my day-to-day in covering such a quintessential challenge and problem, and, you know, I'm always open. Here's the thing. I'm very open to receive ideas from anybody. My email and work email is public, carlos.perezbeltran@nbcuni.com. We love hyper-local communities. So if you have a story, please reach out. We could be there very soon to tell a story in your town.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say, for me, I mean, I've benefited from your work. I love the whole team that you work with. They seem to be fairly clear in their communications, and they're always telling a great story. So thanks for your time with us today, and thanks for what you do to kind of help tell the story in a more human way. Thank you.
And thank you for this, what you're doing. It's very helpful.
Good. Enjoyed having you on Path to Zero. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path to zero@propane.com.